Welcome to the Spark Weekly. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on the program this week, a new book about how star baseball players like Babe Ruth and Shoeless Joe Jackson avoided military service in World War I by playing baseball for Bethlehem steel plants, including in Lebanon and Steelton. Also, we talk with former Obama social secretary and author Deesha Dyer.
Patriotism and a rush to serve in the military characterized America when the U.S. entered World War I in 1917. Those who didn't enlist in hopes of fighting in Europe or tried to avoid the military draft were called slackers. At the time, baseball was by far the American pastime. Dozens of Major League Baseball players like Ty Cobb and Christy Mathewson did enlist. But some of the biggest names in the sport, like Babe Ruth and Shoeless Joe Jackson, played in baseball leagues formed by Bethlehem steel plants or shipyards. There were teams in Lebanon and Steelton here in central Pennsylvania. And most of the best players joined teams in Pennsylvania and Delaware. A new book called Work, Fight, or Play Ball, How Bethlehem Steel Helped Baseball Stars Avoid World War I, chronicles the industrial and shipyard leagues. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author William Eckenbarger is with us today. Bill Eckenbarger, welcome to the program.
Good to be here, Scott. Thank you.
All right, so in the early part of the 20th century, when you hear about the history of baseball, you often hear about Major League ball players barnstorming, playing amateurs or semi-pro. But the Bethlehem Steel League and the shipyard leagues, you don't quite hear as much about that. Why is that?
I don't know. I was surprised to learn that Babe Ruth played in Lebanon, and that got me started. And it's not a widely known story.
It really isn't. And I mean, these leagues played over what, two or three seasons?
Two seasons.
1917, 1918?
Yes.
Okay. So why did you write this book?
Well, I'm a baseball fan. I always have been a baseball fan, and I always wanted to write a book about baseball. And I had a real fun time doing it. It took me about a year and a half or so, but it was actually fun to do.
We were talking before the program today. You've written a number of books, including the Kids for Cash book in northeastern Pennsylvania.
Yes.
That book wasn't so fun to write, so this is kind of the complete opposite of that, huh?
Exactly. That book was very, very heavy and very, very disturbing to write.
Yeah.
And it actually affected me for a long time.
Yeah, just so everyone knows, to provide some context, what was that case about?
Well, there were two judges who were sending kids away to a privately owned juvenile detention center and getting over $2 million in kickback from the center, and the kids hadn't done things that would cause them to be incarcerated. It was like for shoplifting and disrespecting a teacher, they got essentially sent to jail for that.
Yeah, so you can see where this would be much more fun, much more pleasant to write than something about that. So describe America as it went to war in 1917.
Well, there were German spies everywhere. You were required, the big thing was to do your bit. And everyone was expected to participate in the war effort. And those who didn't do that were called slackers. And so horrible was the term that if a criminal defendant was called a slacker, it was grounds for overturning, for a new trial, because the term was so offensive that it would prejudice the jury.
How is this different than, say, a draft dodger in Vietnam?
Well, I think the Vietnam War was much more controversial. There was not the widespread public support there was for World War I.
So that was the key, that the country was so far in so much in support of the war, and which is kind of ironic because they wanted to stay out of the war until we actually went to war.
Right, exactly. The war started in 1914, and we didn't get it until 1917. It really didn't start sending troops over there until 1918.
Mm-hmm. So there were several industries or occupations that were considered essential in America at the time. Baseball was one of them.
No, baseball was not one of them.
But there were some people. I mean, officially it wasn't considered essential, but in the eyes of many, it was considered essential.
Especially the baseball owners.
Essential. Oh, yeah. Well, Woodrow Wilson thought that baseball should continue.
Yes, he thought so. But there was something issued called the Work or Fight Order. It was issued by the War Department. It was what we call the Pentagon back then. And it essentially said that either you have to work in a central industry or be drafted in the armed force. It affected any young men between 18 and 32. And so the essential industries were farming, that was one, munitions plants, and steel mills and shipyards. So that was one way to get out of the draft, was to work in one of those industries.
But why did the baseball season continue?
Well, they shortened the season, and they allowed the teams to play out, and they actually had the World Series in September, which was unusual.
Mm. Major League Baseball teams at the start of the war tried to show their support for the war effort. And I have to say that after reading some of the things you describe in the book, it was almost comical in some ways.
It was absurd. They had teams would come out on the field, and they would shoulder their bats like they were rifles, and they would march to a army officer would march them, and they'd march out to the flag and salute the flag and then march back. It was almost comically absurd.
But teams were drilled, right?
Drilled, yes. It was very, very serious stuff. The Major League Baseball wanted to show that it was doing its bit, and that was one way they did it. And they were hoping to get baseball declared as an essential industry, but of course they failed.
Mm. Somehow I can't picture Bryce Harper putting his bat on his shoulder like a rifle and marching.
That is hard to picture, yes.
So how did the Bethlehem Steel League form?
Well, Charles Schwab, who is not the Charles Schwab we know.
I have to say that when I first read the name in the book, that's the first thing I thought of was Charles Schwab, the financial guru.
Completely different guy, but at the time as famous as the Charles Schwab we know. He formed a league of six teams. They were in three Pennsylvania steel mills: Bethlehem, Steelton, Lebanon, and then a steel mill near Baltimore, and a shipyard in Wilmington, Delaware, and a shipyard near Boston. And those are six teams. And they originally the original players were guys who worked at those plants. But in 1918, some of the major leaguers figured out that if they could get on one of those teams, they would be in an essential industry, and they would be exempt from the draft. And so there began a slight exodus. But then in May, Shoeless Joe Jackson he was deferred from the draft. He had a dependent wife. He had his mother was dependent on him. He had two sisters who were dependent on him, and three of his brothers were already in the military. But somehow his draft board rescinded his exemption, and he became 1A. And that's when he fled to the shipyard in Wilmington. And so after that, the major leaguers said, well, if he can get drafted, anybody can get drafted. So that really pushed the exodus to these teams.
Yeah, for those who aren't baseball fans or don't know the history, Shoeless Joe Jackson was one of the greatest players, greatest hitters in the game at the time. How did he get up to 1A with all those exemptions he could have used?
Well, he must have done something to anger his draft board, because at the time, local draft boards had complete power. They didn't have to reason, they didn't have to explain anything, and the only thing his biographers can think of is that he did something to anger one of the members of the draft board.
Yeah, Shoeless Joe Jackson was illiterate.
Yes.
I mean, would he just make an X?
He was completely... He was a really good hitter, but that was it. He had no No other smarts.
Now, what team did he play for?
He played for the Harlan Shipyard in Wilmington, Delaware.
Now, that was in the Shipyard League.
Yes.
Did he play in the Bethlehem?
No, they had the Harlan had teams in both leagues.
Okay, that's right. Okay, yeah. In Bethlehem Steel. Yeah, and so how often was Shoeless Joe Jackson playing?
He played once a week. He played mainly in the Bethlehem Steel League. And he played once a week, and then on weekends, on Sundays, he was off, and he would do things to raise money for the war effort. Mm.
Yeah, Shoeless Joe Jackson actually did some work, right?
He actually worked at the shipyard, yes.
Not all players did that.
Babe Ruth sure didn't, no.
Now, what did Babe Ruth do?
Babe Ruth had his job title was Blueprint Messenger. And no one quite knew what that meant, but I've talked to people who remember him at the steel mill, and they said that he showed up in very expensive clothes, hang around for a couple hours, talked about baseball, and then walked out, and that was it. That was his work day.
Now, which Bethlehem Steel team was he on?
Lebanon.
He was on the Lebanon team.
Yes.
So where was the field in Lebanon?
It was on, Green Street and Third and Green.
Yeah.
It was at the mill.
Yeah, I was going to say right where the mill is.
It's not there anymore.
But Babe Ruth played for the Lebanon team.
Yes.
How often did he play for the Lebanon
team? He actually played one game. And he struck out twice, and he was intentionally walked, and he played first base. At that time, remember, Babe Ruth was mainly a pitcher with the Boston Red Sox. He had not gotten to the Yankees or Yankee Stadium or the House of Ruth. That was all in the future.
Yeah, you said, and he was still playing for the Red Sox at the time that he was with the Lebanon team in the Bethlehem Steel League. But the thing, as you write in the book, many of the soldiers who were overseas were still interested in.
Yes.
It looks like they didn't see them as slackers. They were still interested in baseball. And this is when Babe Ruth started hitting home runs. Yes. So they were very interested in what Ruth was doing.
Well, what happened was the Red Sox started to lose players to the draft. So the manager needed some more outfielders. So Ruth, the pitcher, they knew he could hit pretty well. So they made him play the outfield, and that was the transition. In fact, he led the league that year in home runs with 11 home runs, which is more than many teams hit.
Bill Eckenbarger, we were just talking about Babe Ruth. You said that he led the league with 11 home runs, but he actually hit more than 11, right?
He actually hit 13 home runs, but they had an unusual rule that I was totally blown away to learn, that if the game went into extra innings and there was a person on first base and the batter hit a home run, once that person on first base crossed home plate, the game was over. So the batter did not get credit for a home run, he got credit for a triple.
Yeah, just think how many times how many home runs Barry Bonds or Babe Ruth or Hank Aaron would have, how fewer home runs they would have if that rule was still in effect. All right, so the players that did work in the plants, okay, maybe worked is not the right word. Some did, you said, Shoeless Joe Jackson, but many others didn't. Were they considered slackers?
Well, it's kind of interesting. They did have a rebellion at one of the shipyards. The real workers thought that the players were getting privileges, but the games were always well attended. They averaged between 3,000 and 5,000 people at a game, which is phenomenal. They drew more people than some major league teams, and one game in Bethlehem they had 18,000 people at. So
the fans, although they may call them slackers, they still thought so much they wanted to see baseball. I mean, I guess it was a way for many people back home to be entertained.
Yes. Yeah. You have to remember that if you wanted to know what happened in a game, you either had to go to the game or you had to read about it the next day in the newspaper because there was no radio, no TV. So a very small percentage of fans actually went to the game. So the newspapers carried batter by batter summaries of the game. So long, long stories about the baseball games.
You didn't start at the Philadelphia Inquirer when they were still doing that, did you?
No,
that's no comment on your age or anything.
No.
And when you were at the Inquirer, you didn't write about sports.
No, I was not a sports writer. No, indeed.
That's where you won a Pulitzer Prize for your coverage of the Three Mile Island accident. So there were some players who were drafted or enlisted and fought, right?
Yes. The greatest player of the day was Ty Cobb of the Detroit Tigers, and he was exempt because he had two kids, but he enlisted, and not only did he enlist, but he went into the Army Chemical Warfare Division, which was considered the most dangerous duty in the Army. It was defending the troops against poisonous gas attacks, and they had some really dangerous situations over there.
Describe what that unit actually did, because I mean, when I read that, I was, oh my, they were like risking lives.
Yeah,
their training,
their lives were risked every day. Christy Mathewson was in that unit, and he was gassed. He was actually gassed, and it ended his career.
And Christy Mathewson from Central Pennsylvania outside of Lewisburg.
That's right, that's right.
The football stadium at Bucknell University, named for Christy Mathewson. When he retired, and what still is, third on the all-time list in wins. Pitcher he is tied with, Grover Cleveland Alexander. Now, I have to admit, when I was a kid, I saw a movie starring Ronald Reagan and Doris Day. If I remember correctly, it was called The Winning Team.
I remember that, yeah.
About Grover Cleveland Alexander. Yeah. Now, that kind of whitewashed his problems that he had.
Yes.
But Alexander was one of the best pitchers in Major League history for the Phillies. But then was traded to the Cubs and then eventually the Cardinals. But when he went to war, it had a great impact on his life.
Yes, he never got over the experience of the war, which is of course a trench warfare and he ended up with a drinking problem and all kinds of negative things.
You quoted a biographer of Alexander in the book saying that, he's an epileptic as well, that Alexander drank to hide his epilepsy.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And remember, this is 1917, 1918. 1918 especially, what was known as the Spanish flu. What impact did that have on, first of all, the military, but then the baseball players as well?
Babe Ruth got the Spanish flu, and he recovered, but it did affect, as the season wore on, there were fewer fans coming to the Major League games because they were either ill or they feared contagion.
Did it have an impact on the Bethlehem Steel League? Or the
Hard to know because there's no way to gauge who came in previous years, but I'm sure it did.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned six teams in the Bethlehem Steel League, Shipyard League as well on the East Coast, but there were other teams, industrial teams and shipyard teams in the country, right?
Yes, there were industrial leagues all over the place, and they existed before the war, I remember baseball was the sport. Every town, every church, every union, everybody had a baseball team.
Mm. So, do you have an idea of how many baseball players played in these industrial and shipyard leagues to avoid going to? I guess there's really no way to know whether that was what inspired them to do it, but major league players who played in these leagues.
I would say in the two leagues, probably between 50 and 60 major leaguers, plus a lot of minor leaguers, too, that did the same thing.
Yeah, you talked about a lot of the guys that got maybe one at bat in the major leagues who you know, when they were with steelworkers, they were pretty good players. What about you mentioned? I've been focused a lot on the Lebanon team and the Steelton team because they're right here in our area. The Lebanon team seemed to be pretty good.
Yeah, they won the championship in 1917, the first year of the. But of course, they didn't. There were no major leaguers then. But in 1918, Steelton had the best team.
Mm.
Who were some of the players that would be recognized?
Joe McCarthy, who went on to be the manager of the Hall of Fame manager of the Yankees, and a bunch of lesser stars, but certified major leaguers.
You know, something I found interesting was the Chicago White Sox in 1919. They would become infamous for throwing the World Series. But some of the players who were on the White Sox, including Cecilus Joe Jackson, but some of the other players that we recognize their name from that scandal played in the Bethlehem Steel League.
Yes. The two of them, the two of Jackson's teammates at the White Sox went to play with him at the Harlan team. And it became known that if... he got blamed for everything. Joe Jackson blamed for everything. So if a major leaguer went to one of these teams, it was said he went the Joe Jackson route.
You know, one of the things I find interesting, though, is that even though some of the workers at the plants or the shipyards weren't real happy with these players because they weren't doing a lot of work otherwise, the fans, after the war, I mean, it didn't hurt Babe Ruth's popularity at all.
No, not at all. No, when of course no one knew that the war was going to end in 1918. In fact, the Major League had canceled the season in 1919. But then, when the war was over, they reinstated the season and they welcomed back everyone. There was no problem with the so-called slackers or anything like that.
The name of the book is Work, Fight, or Play Ball: How Bethlehem Steel Helped Baseball Stars Avoid World War I, by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author William Eckenbarger. Bill, thank you very much for being with us today.
Enjoyed it very much, Scott. Thank you.
Coming up on the second half of the Spark Weekly, we talk with former Obama Social Secretary and author Deesha Dyer. You're listening to the Spark Weekly. I'm Scott Lamar.
Welcome back to the Spark Weekly. I'm Marquise Lupton. Deesha Dyer is a speaker and creative event strategy consultant who was most notably known as the former Obama administration's social secretary. And this Philadelphia native and former hip-hop journalist became a White House intern at the age of 30 while attending community college. She led a team that coordinated the 2015 visit of Pope Francis, as well as coordinating state dinners with heads of states from China, Canada, and Italy, and booked legendary performances by some names you may recognize: Beyoncé, Bruce Springsteen, and the cast of the Broadway musical Hamilton. And today, this Milton Hershey graduate comes to the Spark to discuss her new book, Undiplomatic, where Deesha shares her roadmap from imposter to impact. And I'm happy to have her on the Spark with us today. Deesha, hello. Good afternoon.
Hello. 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 Good afternoon. It's so good to be here with you.
Yes, likewise. So I'm just going to jump right into things here. Milton Hershey, can you tell us about your time there? You know, as a local regional person that's doing so many dope things, you know, can you tell us about your origin story being at Milton Hershey?
Definitely. So Milton Hershey School, as most people know, is in Hershey, Pennsylvania. And I went there when I was in fifth grade. My brother and I, who were a couple years older than us, my parents are divorced. And my mom knew it better to put me somewhere that I could get a good, stable education, have a good, stable home life. So I went to Milton Hershey and I was there from my fifth grade years until I graduated. So I was a senior. And I would say that, you know, I was a wayward child, very much so, I think, at Milton Hershey, really, you know, finding my footing, you know, without my family there, but definitely took advantage of volunteer opportunities and other things that were afforded to us at Milton Hershey, where I, you know, really got the grounding of community there. But I learned a lot about myself there and learned about others. And so, yes, that's kind of my origin story of how I got to Milton Hershey.
So your time post Milton Hershey, but prior to the Obama administration, what were you doing?
I was doing a lot. I went to college and then dropped out of college. And then I was a hip hop journalist for a number of years. And then I worked at the mall. I did a lot of things. A lot of things I did also were in the community. So I was an HIV/AIDS advocate for since I was 14 years old, actually at Milton Hershey. And so I continued that. A lot of my activism around women, around feminine rights, around Black rights, did a bunch of that between after graduation until I applied to go to Community College of Philadelphia at 29 years old, which then led me to apply for a White House internship in my 30s. And so then that's when my White House career started when I was 31.
Shout out to CCP. Shout out to
Yes.
CCP. Yeah, definitely. Now you applied to this internship at the White House, and you are a community college student. You know, this is something that is out of the realm of normalcy here. So this is
Yeah.
one of those moments that I like to point out when I say, oh, you're trusting your dopeness here. So can you take us to that moment, as this community college student, 29 years old, again, against the grain, against tradition, what was it that made you want to apply for this internship?
Definitely. For me, somebody who had not been involved in politics too much, but still was really a community activist, I didn't really ever see myself in politics. I didn't understand it. I think, like m many of us, I just saw it from a distance and was like, oh, that doesn't affect me. So I was kind of, too young and not, civically engaged or educated enough to understand. But then when President Obama, then Senator Obama, started running for president and he started giving speeches and people in the community started talking about this man that was kind of on the scene, talking about things in the community from poverty to trans rights to education, I really gravitated towards that. And I think that that really hooked me in the sense of saying, this is amazing. Can I be part of this whole, hope and change campaign that this man is questing to bring to America? And I didn't think I was qualified. I didn't think that I would ever get an internship. I didn't understand even what an internship was. I thought I was too old. And when I got the community college, I got to community college and learned a little bit more about internships, and then got the White House internship across my desk one day for somebody to say, Deisha, can you pass this on to the mentees in your community who you mentor that are in college? I decided to look into it a little bit further and apply. I fit all the qualifications. I was in school. There was no age restriction. There was no education restriction besides having to be in college. And you had to write an essay. And I was a writer, so I wrote the essay. And then in September 2009, I started the internship at 31.
Now, can you take us to that moment when you got that acceptance letter, acceptance email? Can you describe what you read and just the emotions that were running through?
Well, I got the email, but I didn't see it. So I did not know that I got accepted until I got a phone call asking me about my paperwork. And so I didn't turn in the paperwork, the security clearance that you had to turn in to be an intern that was attached to the email that I actually never saw. And so that's how I found out that I became an in that I got the internship was actually through this phone call. So once the phone call came, I dug in that black hole of Gmail, finding it in the archive, found the email, and then read it, the acceptance. And I think my heart just dropped. I mean, I couldn't believe, that they wanted me as an intern. I couldn't believe that I, had beat out probably hundreds of thousands of candidates who wanted to work with this president in the first year. And I kept thinking there's going to be something that's going to stop this. And, but I said, I'm just going to keep, filling out the paperwork and going forward. So it was absolutely unbelievable. It was, a magical time. I think the same feeling I felt when President Obama got elected. And, it just was trying to figure out everything from there to make sure that I had everything turned in for the internship.
Now, receiving that phone call, was that a what you talking about, Willis type moment?
It was 100% that. I mean, it was more like, who me? Like, who, like, you had the right Deisha Dyer? Like, is there another name? Like, And I also was very surprised that I didn't see the email. Mm. But I think I deleted it and thinking it was a spam email. That's what happened. And it was definitely a what you talk about. It was definitely a can you resend the paperwork? It was definitely, oh my goodness. And thankfully I had somebody on the phone who was like, let me call this intern versus saying they just didn't get back to us. Let us choose someone else. So it could have been completely different had I got a different person on the phone who like looked through the applications and said, oh, we're missing her paperwork.
Oh, yeah. So now let's to talk about your tenure there briefly. Now, you set up some significant things, state dinners. Mm-hmm. You coordinated with something with Beyonce and Bruce Springsteen. Can you tell us about this social secretary position? Because this is honestly the first time that I heard about it. What is it? What do you do? And what was some of your favorite aspects of the job?
Definitely. So the social secretary is a senior position that sits in the First Lady's office. And that role is to execute all of the events, public and private, that happen for the First Family or for the nation or for anything inside of the actual mansion. So inside the actual White House. And so I led that charge and I worked with countless folks besides the people that worked in my office. It was like working with the chefs and the butlers and the florists, the calligraphers, to make sure that we put events together. We would do everything from, as you mentioned, state dinners to concerts, but also we would do things like sports championships and we would do message events around, you know, critical issues around gun violence or education. And we honored teachers. So everything from the beginning to the end of an event, I was in charge of putting together, making sure that it all came together. There was a run of show by every minute of how things would go, from putting out chairs to serving food to when the president or first lady took the stage. I would, you know, work with the other departments on making sure their speech was laid properly on the podium, communicating with them all the details so they could ask any questions about, you know, how is this set up? Where do I walk? Who's all in the room? And then working with them along the way, the president and first lady, on the actual details to make sure it represents them, right? Make sure it represents the house, make sure it represents what they want to do. Mrs. Obama was very big on opening the house and making it the people's house. And so I just basically took the direction from her and expanded with all the events. And so that's what the social secretary does.
Oh, wow. So then you got to sit down and chat and strategize with Michelle Obama then. How was that?
Yes, it was nerve-wracking. I mean, anybody's nervous, of course. She's Michelle Obama. But I think that I just, you know, she always put me at ease. And I think that I just led with my community background and desire to want to execute, you know, the vision that she was putting forth. And so, you know, I just think I was trying to live up to the confidence that she had in me to do the job and just, you know, relied on my other coworkers and my team to really fill in the gaps of things I didn't know or things where I was, you know, slipping up. But it was, of course, intimidating. but I got through it.
Now you wrote this book, Undiplomatic, and we're going to get more into it on the other side of the break. But I did want to first talk about this dealing with imposter syndrome, because we all deal with imposter syndrome, especially those who are BIPOC, you know. So with yourself, how did you cope with this imposter syndrome while interfacing with the First Lady?
I didn't cope too well. You know, that's part of the reason why I wrote the book. I think that I coped by, you know, putting a lot of onus on myself of, you know, you didn't finish college, you know, you're not smart enough. Mm. Like, you know, you're only here because, you know, they thought that you were, you know, you were good at what you did, but can you actually live up to this new responsibility? And so I think that it was very hard for me, which is, you know, again, why I wrote the book. But also on the other side of that is I worked really hard at making sure that my work product and the things that I put out were so excellent that there wasn't really a room to say, like, she isn't qualified. You know, not everything wasn't perfect, but I think that I made it so my work was so on point. But later down the line, as the book goes to the evolution of me with this imposter syndrome, you know, you see that I started to divest from it. I started to divorce it in a way to say, no, I am qualified. Like, whose standards am I trying to live up to? Like, you know, why am I putting the onus on myself of things that happened in the past that make me feel not wanted or not deserved. And so I turned that around, you know, with a bunch of therapy and other things. But I think that the First Lady and President having confidence in me really helped, because I was thinking these are two really powerful people and they're saying that you could do it. So who are you to tell yourself that you can't? Right. And so I learned, you know, the evolution through the evolution of, you know, myself, how to deal with it. But in the beginning, it was very hard. And I can say that, you know, it manifested its way itself in many ways.
Before I get into those details, in your bio, you described yourself as a round the way girl, you know. First thing, I'm a hip hop head, so that just, you know, activated, you know, I need a round the way, you know.
Exactly.
so can you tell us how do you infuse that into your leadership and authenticity?
Definitely. And I love that you're a hip hop head, because that is the whole point, right? Of saying that. But you know, for me, I lead with the culture, you know, that is what I grew up in. That is who I am. So I don't know how to be anything else. You know, I don't have this huge pedigree of, you know, education behind me or strong family structure or some of the other things that people have to lean on. For me, I leaned on the culture, right? Mm. And so I always make sure that I bring the community with me wherever I go, whether that's at the White House when, you know, we think of an idea around education and I say, well, why don't we bring in a DJ or a breakdancer? Or, you know, whether I'm writing my essay like I did for the White House internship and I was like, this is how I feel hip hop can really help with education in urban communities. For me, not only that, but I make sure I bring talent from the community. I make sure that I'm being a voice in the room, saying, you know, we're talking about, you know, economic issues. Let's talk about poverty in this, you know, in this realm. Let's talk about this. And so I lead really with the culture and with the community at all times. That means I'm also in touch with the community and culture at all times. So even at the White House, I would go to, you know, ciphers and I would go to different things that were in Washington, D.C., poetry readings, breakdancing competitions. I would go to like different and see different Black churches and choirs to see if they come sing at the White House. Like I was always in touch with the community and the culture. That is how I lead. That's how I want to see want the community to see me as a leader. And so that is how I remain authentic. And it hasn't changed. I mean, you know, I quote hip hop a lot in the book. I quote how I listen to it on the way going to work. I still wear my hoop earrings, my door knockers with my name on them. I have my nose ring still. So it's not a lot that has changed, but that's because that is the only person I knew how to be. Yeah. And that's part of the book's, you know, that's part of the book's mystique and part of the book's love is like, I walked in who I was, you know, and I still remained who I was. Even though there were challenges of being like, I look a little different, I feel a little bit different, none of those affected my work or my success at all. It affected me internally, but then again, I fixed that, right? But that's how I lead really with authenticity.
And what are some main components, some key things that you want your readers to glean from Undiplomatic?
Number one, I want readers to take away the mystique that like or the image that politics or any kind of esteem sector that seems closed off and elite is not for them. I want to kind of take away this whole I don't fit in, I don't belong there, I don't have the skills, the assets, the education. None of that is true. You just have to apply and try. That's it, right? I think that too often we are kind of looking at things and we say we're not qualified or we don't look like the next person, but perhaps they're not looking for a copycat. They're looking for somebody else who's a little bit different. Yeah. That doesn't make everybody else bad. It just means that you're coming with a different set of unique skills. So that's one thing. I think the second thing is that imposter syndrome is really a sham, really. It's a whole thing that's made up to make you feel at fault for things that are out of your control. You cannot control that, you know, you don't have the same education. That's fine. That doesn't mean that you're not qualified, right? Like, or control some of the other oppressive systems that are set up to keep us feeling like we don't deserve things, right? Yeah. You know, that's the number one thing I want to take is like, I want people to take the weight off of themselves about imposter syndrome and feeling so heavy about it. So then they can walk in their confidence. They can know they can do things. They can walk with their head tall. And I want people to know that like, this is a testimony. Like, I took the test so nobody else had to. Mm. And this is my testimony that I'm sharing. I'm hoping that it's entertaining and inspiring and hilarious for people. But also, I want people to see themselves in the story, which is why it's an evolution of where I started versus where I ended versus writing the book from just a healed and ended place around imposter syndrome. Mm.
So where are you at now in your imposter syndrome journey?
You know, that's a great question. And what I'll say is I don't ever say I'm over it. Mm. I would say that I've navigated it and put it off to the side. It's no longer a main dish on my plate. Mm. It comes up when I do things like write a book because I've never written a book before, mm-hmm. right? We act like when we go into new spaces that we're supposed to know what we're doing. We're not. Like, we don't know. I don't know how to do this. And so with every new challenge that I give myself, like writing a book or doing all these press interviews, I do feel a little nervous because, you know, that's just, I've never done it before. But now I know it's not the imposter syndrome. It's not that I'm not qualified. It's just new to me. Mm. So I think that that's how I approach things now, is that it's a learning. It's a curiosity. It's not a bad thing that somebody else has more education or somebody else has more pedigree, or somebody else has more connections. That's not a bad thing. What's a bad thing is if I don't dig deep into who I am and use what I have, right, to then apply to whatever I'm trying to do. So that's where I am on the journey now. I'm on the journey of, this is a scam. Like, this is, you set me up. Like, universe, you set me up to feel like things were my fault and my responsibility, and I had to go get more education. I had to do all these things to keep up with people or to keep up with opportunities. But yet then you showed me I had this whole path, this amazing path that showed me, no, I didn't, yeah. right? And so that is where I am now with it.
So how did you navigate that space writing a book about imposter syndrome while battling imposter syndrome? It's quite the conundrum.
I mean, you don't even know. It sure was. It was quite the conundrum because it was hilarious because I kept telling my husband, and he'd be like, Deesha, you're writing a book about this. I'm like, I know, but I don't know if I'm qualified. He was like, who else is qualified? You are qualified. I'm like, you know, you're right. You know, I did a whole course at Harvard Kennedy School and Institute of Politics around imposter to impact. And I remember being in the room and being like, I'm at Harvard. Like, what do these kids need to know from me? I need to be sitting in their classes. But they had a lot to learn. You know what I mean? And I think that for me, when I was writing the book, I had to forgive myself for times that I was stuck in the matrix of imposter syndrome. Mm. And it's hard when you write about your past life because you're thinking to yourself, well, you know, I would have never made this decision now, yeah. you know, like, but you have to be like, I don't have the knowledge and the evolution and the healing and the therapy that I have now. I didn't have it then. So I think that writing about it was a whole practice of forgiveness, is a practice of compassion, is a practice of grace. And it also was a practice of just like, I never want to be in that space again. And so I need to make sure that I write this book authentically. So when I need to read it back, so I can remember, you know, if I ever slip, that it is going to be a resource for me and for others. But it definitely was a conundrum. It definitely was a like, oh, is that what I said? And I had to stay true to how I felt then because I didn't want to mislead readers like, oh, yeah, I thought I wasn't qualified, but I went for it and felt great. Mm. Like that really wasn't how it happened. And so I had to be honest that even with these promotions and accolades and all these things, I still was like treading water, you know, until I wasn't. So, yeah.
Deesha, real quick, because we are at the end of our show. Where can folks purchase the book at?
They can purchase the book anywhere that they get books, any kind of major retailer, independent store. I make sure your libraries carry, you can ask, but also all that's online. But if you need like a little cheat sheet, just DeeshaDyer.com. And it has all the places listed where you could buy the book. But wherever you can buy it, especially from our indie friends, would be really great.
All right. Well, Deesha, I want to thank you for coming on the Spark today and giving us the game, as I like to say. Yeah. Thank you for coming on the Spark.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, my pleasure. Have a good one. Thank you for joining us on the Spark Weekly and making us a part of your day. Coming up tomorrow, I chat with some doctors from UPMC about autism and discuss the state of services available for those on the spectrum. And then on Thursday, we spend the entire show discussing prison and sentencing reform with a slew of guests. You definitely don't want to miss that. I am Marquise Lupton. This is The Spark Weekly, and have yourself a wonderful week.